This is lesson three, the biblical plan, comma, announcement of the Great Commission. Now, in the previous two lessons, we mentioned seven different mysteries. One, matter; two, life; three, the Cambrian explosion and the first appearance of predation; four, humans; five, the new beginning of Eden and the fall of Adam; six, the consequent declining of ancient high civilizations; and seven, the Abrahamic new beginning. But we hardly touched on the latter three mysteries. In this lesson, we begin to move into the period addressed by the Bible itself. We now leave the first four mysteries behind, since presumably they occur prior to Genesis 1:1. Thus, we pass over the possibility that the previous 500 million years of repeated asteroidal collisions were earlier examples of new beginnings. We focus now on the aftermath of what could have been the most recent asteroidal collision in the region of the Middle East. That is, we begin in more detail with the last three mysteries, which are number five, the new beginning of Genesis and the fall of Adam; number six, the decline and degeneration following Adam's fall; and seven, the specific new beginning of the biblical story from Genesis 12 to the present. Thus, to repeat, we will deal with the following elements in the story. We begin and assume the pre-biblical distortion of all creation. We talk about the first mystery, the Edenic new beginning in a region of recent devastation, ending with the fall of Adam. The sixth mystery, the aftermath of Adam's fall, the decline of everything. Seven, the temporary Noahic new beginning. The temporary Noahic new beginning. This is a word. Noahic is not in the Merriam-Webster dictionary, but if you look it up in Google, you have a whole flock of websites that talk about the Noahic period, meaning the period of Noah and his sons. So I'm just using it. The temporary Noahic new beginning. It was temporary because it didn't last very long. The following that, then we have the seventh mystery, which the whole Bible is talking about, everything from Genesis 12 to the present, the Abrahamic new beginning, which extends to the present, that is, what was and still is the little understood plan of redemption and restoration, the sort of thing Paul was forced to call a mystery. This is the seventh and final mystery. It will take all of the rest of this and subsequent lessons to describe the unfolding of that plan. Well, let's go back for a second to Mystery 5. As mentioned, the Edenic new beginning in Genesis 1:1 was quite possibly built, according to my suppositions, upon a vast regional devastation, very likely in the realm of the Fertile Crescent. In other words, the early events, as recorded in Genesis chapter 1, do not appear to record the events of an original creation, either of the earth or of life, but rather seem to describe the sequence following a major asteroidal collision and the new and sinless recreation of both animals and human life, which are characterized indelibly by non-carnivorous behavior. Now, Genesis goes on to record the seduction and deception of this new creation, the breakdown of the Edenic new beginning, the inevitable exposure to disease, and the gradual reversion to shorter lifespans, the reversion to carnivorous behavior, and the looming, essentially hopeless destruction of war and pestilence. Now that Mystery 5 is taken up in the early chapters of Genesis. Mystery 6, we also notice the decline of the ancient archaic, quote, archaic civilizations, that's a Toynbee term, whose sophistication was evidently superior to what came later. This is Mystery 6. Note that it is the very opposite of evolution, of social evolution at least. We can take note of the decline of the Sumerian civilization from which Abraham came. His kids went to school, and unlike ours, whose most difficult arithmetic task is to derive the square root manually, in those days they derived the cube root manually, which is very much more complicated. And now this is a long time ago, but this was the very end of an 800-year decline of civilization, and they were still that sophisticated. So it's rather confusing in terms of evolution. We see a similar decline in the Egyptian civilization because the Great Pyramids and the Sphinx were the work of the early period of Egyptian history. We note the more sophisticated earlier civilization behind the Incas in Peru. There were two, actually, the Tiwanacos and then an earlier one still, both of them higher than the previous, than the following one. We see the same thing behind the Maya in Mexico and Central America. And we note the early civilization that produced the Stonehenge Observatory, a project which could not be fully understood by later generations and has been a problem even for modern astronomers. Well, that is a mystery. Sociologists, historians, paleontologists really have no explanation for this apparent decline of civilizations. There is a Russian scholar who suggested that they obviously came from outer space, full-blown, landing on the Earth, and there were, because there doesn't seem to be any gradual evolutionary lead-up to their sophistication. So this is an enigma, and what I've called it is a mystery. Then, mystery seven. In terms of God's strategy, we see selectivity as he selects Noah for survival in his part of the world, whose offspring re-inhabit the whole Middle East. Later, God selects Abraham to be the carrier of faith and blessing to the rest of the world. We read of Isaac being selected instead of Ishmael, Jacob instead of Esau. We see Moses being selected and then Joshua. We see the southern kingdom emerging instead of all Israel. We see the small remnant returning from Babylon, two-thirds of the people remaining in Babylon. By Jesus' day, only one-third had returned to the land of their fathers. We see selectivity, of course, in the case of Galilee of the Gentiles, of all places, rather than Jerusalem. Nazareth, of all places, even within Galilee. Why Nazareth? And then we see the selection of Mary. Now, such selectivity has often been interpreted as exclusivity. Thus, we are surprised when Abraham is judged immoral by Abimelech, a man who was completely outside the Abrahamic covenant. It would seem that the Bible reports accurately and critically on a nation and its story, a story which is not altogether admirable. For example, much of the Bible describes almost exaggeratedly objectionable behavior. Thus, the British historian Herbert Butterfield remarked that the uniqueness of the story of the Jewish people, namely the Bible, that's their story, is not their history, but their historiography. Apparently, selection has had as much or more to do with the task of reporting to posterity and other nations as it has been to be a matter of gaining exclusive favors. Furthermore, the Bible obviously does not contain all the things God has said and done among all the nations of the world. We don't always remember that fact. It is common for Christians to assume that God's selectivity has really been intended to be exclusivity, and that God spoke to and through the Jewish tradition and to and through none other. Thus, again, echoing Butterfield, we can, in the case of the Jewish people and their Bible, understand that it is the perspective of the record and not the content of the record that is the most unique. In other words, the amazing and unique literary record we have in the Bible, despite its admirable honesty and self-criticism, does not merely talk about human events that were unique or universal. With surprising accuracy, it does describe people and their experiences and their understanding of things in the situation in which they found themselves, and their understanding is one of the key points. It is important to remind ourselves that there is a big difference between believing in an inerrant Bible and believing in inerrant interpretations of the Bible. Now, in regard to our interpretation of Genesis, or any part of the Bible for that matter, there are at least three possibilities. First, that what is said was meaningful to both the human author and his hearers or readers. This is the usual situation in the Bible. Second, that what was said had a double meaning. It was meaningful at the time and also described something that was going on to happen in the future. This is much rarer, but we do see it, for example, in some of the Psalms and references in Isaiah to Christ in the New Testament. Thirdly, it is even more rarely possible that what was said was confusing and meaningless to the human author and audience at the time, and only described something in the future which was unknown at the time. Now, in the particular case of Genesis chapter 1, we can begin by assuming, it seems to me, the usual case, that it was meaningful to the ancients producing it, and that it did not miraculously represent insight into the entire universe unknown at the time, in which case it would have been totally meaningless or misleading to the people at the time it was written. Is it not much more likely that we moderns have anachronistically read our current cosmological knowledge back into the text? If so, that would be quite understandable and forgivable, but it would obscure what the Bible meant at the time it was written, if we did that. Every time we understand the Bible to mean something it doesn't mean, we commit two evils. What we interpret it to mean might be wrong, and then what we cover up, we don't see. So there's a double problem when we do that. Now, this sort of thinking, however, does not require us to insist that the Abrahamic covenant has only a local or regional meaning, since we do not, in this case, have to choose between an ancient meaning of one set of events and a modern understanding to refer to a very different set of events, as it would be if, for instance, Genesis 1:1 referred to the creation of the universe, which is very, very different from simply the creation of our planet or life in a region of the planet. Now, as for the detailed meaning of the Abrahamic covenant, the idea that this is the first case of the Great Commission has been very well explained in the Perspectives course, which many of you have taken. Now here, however, it may be well to look at two aspects of it more closely. First of all, the link to the New Testament. The commission is mentioned in regard to Abraham three times, and once to each Isaac and Jacob. Three times to Abraham, once to Isaac and Jacob. Let me start that over. The commission is mentioned in regard to Abraham three times, and once to each Isaac and Jacob. In Genesis 12:1-3, 18:18, 22:18, and then to Isaac, 26:4-5, and to Jacob in 28:14-15. It's interesting that Genesis 28:15 is closely similar to Matthew 28:20. This does not appear very clearly in English translations, since our Old Testament is a translation of the Hebrew. But the Bible of the early church was Greek, and the New Testament, "I will be with you until the end," in Matthew 28:20, is almost verbatim in Genesis 28:20. Now, this gives rise to the thought that Jesus, in Matthew 28, was consciously paraphrasing the Old Testament Great Commission in the form that it was given to Jacob. Jacob was also called Israel. Jesus was talking specifically to the children of Israel, not the children of Abraham, so that would make sense. But in any case, the key point here is that the Great Commission was not something invented in New Testament times. Furthermore, it is not just Jesus who alludes to these passages. Peter, in Acts 3, quotes the phrase, quote, "In your seed all the families of the earth will be blessed," unquote. And Paul in Galatians 3 says, "Scripture, seeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying," quote, "all the nations shall be blessed in you." Now, while we're on this verse, let's be sure to note that the faith Paul is talking about, that Abraham had, was not what we often glibly call, quote, "the saving knowledge of Christ," unquote. If that phrase means head knowledge, then it's certainly not what it was meant. In the Bible, faith is indissolubly linked to obedience. Indeed, in Romans 1:5, Paul talks about bringing about, quote, "the obedience of faith among all the Gentiles." Abraham's, quote, "saving faith," therefore, did not involve any very detailed knowledge about Christ at all. And the gospel preached to him, Paul summarizes, as the simple fact that is good news that all nations will be included. That's the good news of the gospel, that all nations will be included. Now, that is the basis That is, let me start over. That is, the basis of the gospel is the blood of Christ, the one name under heaven whereby we must be saved. But the message of the gospel, made possible by the basis, is that the Gentiles, not just Israel, are welcomed by God. Okay, let's go on. The blessing, the phrase blessing. We must note that the common English translation, "I will bless you, and you will be a blessing to all the families of the earth," fits in perfectly with our modern prosperity gospel. Again, we usually read into the text what we would like it to mean. In this case, the misleading word is the very word blessing itself. This word is, in the Hebrew, the same word used again and again in the book of Genesis with a very different meaning. Jacob, for example, was blessed, not Esau, for example. Did not mean simply that... In the Hebrew, the same word is used again in the book of Genesis with a different meaning. Jacob, for example, was blessed, not Esau. This did not mean simply that he was to inherit land. It meant he was to shoulder many of the heavy responsibilities of a father now too old to carry them further. It made him the principal carrier of the family name. He was now more officially rooted in the bloodstream of his father than ever before. For us today, the difference between these two meanings of the word blessing is the difference between getting a ticket to heaven, which you can walk off with, and inheriting a permanent relationship to a heavenly family with all the rights and privileges that are involved thereby. This long-term family relationship illuminates the rationale for Jesus saying, quote, "As my Father sent me, so send I you." We are part of that same family. As we have seen earlier, this blessing, this new birth, inducts us into a kingdom at war, not just to a safe holding tank awaiting for heaven. Believers in poverty, oppression, and even semi-starvation tend to sing about the next world. They don't have many hopes for this world. Even evangelicals in years gone by, in their less upscale days, used to sing, "This world is not my home, I'm just a passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. The angels beckon me from heaven's open door, and I can't feel at home in this world anymore. My Savior pardoned me from guilt and shame, I know. I'll trust his saving grace while traveling here below." Notice the traveling has no hint of war here below. "I know he'll welcome me from heaven's open door, and I can't feel at home in this world anymore." Now, this type of otherworldly fixation is less defensible the more secure we become and the more knowledge we gain of what it takes to be loyal to a family, a kingdom, which is at war here and now, striving to set the record straight as to who God is and what he is like and to re-glorify his name. In other words, Adam and his lineage became survivors, but unless reborn spiritually, not soldiers in a war against Satan. Once saved or reborn, we become listed in the Lamb's Book of Life, but we may not be aware of the fact that we are also soldiers enlisted on earth to do our Father's bidding. Maybe I missed a page. No, I didn't. Okay, I'll back up here. We may not be aware of the fact that we are also soldiers enlisted on earth in fight not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, powers, against the rulers of darkness, against spiritual wickedness in high places. And I might add that when Paul said that, he would have had no idea of the incredibly hideous complexity of antagonistic organisms on the microbiological level, which dragged down 9 out of 10 Americans to premature death to this day. Paul, Calvin, Thomas Aquinas, none of those people would have had any insight into that at all. So it is not a matter merely of getting humans into heaven, but getting heaven into humans. Those who are enlisted but don't report for duty are classified as, quote, absent without leave, or AWOL. When Jesus appears on the scene and tells us we should pray, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven," when he assures us, quote, "The gates of hell will not prevail against the onslaught of the church," that is, The fortifications of hell will not be able to resist the destruction of the works of the devil. Our response may merely be, huh? I thought the purpose of the church was to meet my needs and the needs of my family. In a war, of course, soldiers need to eat and to sleep and have their basic needs met, but they are also committed to an enterprise in which they may be injured or killed. Now that sounds like Jesus saying, he who seeks to save his life will lose it, but he who will lose his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. Going AWOL is not necessarily as safe as staying with the troops and fighting the good fight.
Could you say that last sentence one more time?
Okay. I'm sorry. Ever since I had a stroke about 10 years ago, my speech is slurred, and it's a very difficult thing to avoid that. They were also committed to an enterprise in which they may be injured or killed. Now that sounds like Jesus saying, quote, he who seeks to save his life will lose it, but he who will lose his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. That means going AWOL is not necessarily as safe as staying with the troops and fighting the good fight.
He didn't mean to say, and the gospel's, did you?
Okay, I'll do that again. The typewriter made a mistake. For my sake and the gospel is the right. Yeah. Okay. Here we go back again, and this is worth reviewing, by the way. Our response may merely be, "Huh? I thought the purpose of the church was to meet my needs and the needs of my family." In a war, of course, soldiers need to eat and to sleep and to have their basic needs met. But they are also committed to an enterprise in which they may be injured or killed. Now that sounds like Jesus saying, he who seeks to save his life will lose it, but he who will lose his life for my sake and the gospel will save it. That means going AWOL is not necessarily as safe as staying with the troops and fighting the good fight. With just the average amount of stuttering, yeah, this was a little. I began to realize a couple of days ago that the idea of extending it from a half an hour to 40 minutes is probably not a good idea. And he said we could go longer if we wanted. So apparently he can handle the 40-minute talks we have given. But I think in the future we ought to stick to 30 minutes for a presentation and 30 minutes for discussion.
Right, and we'll explain at the beginning of this series that these lectures are to stir up our thinking and to get us, what was the word you said?
Infuriated.
Yeah. So that you agree with questions in mind.
The idea is that it's inhumane for people to read something without somebody tipping them off as the import of it. Years ago we thought it would even be best if they saw a videotape of the person speaking whose material they were going to read. But that idealism didn't quite get fulfilled.
Okay, thank you. We'll meet again next week, right, Barb? We'll be here next Wednesday. I think we're going to hand
out the questions are going to be handled out.
Not the questions, but the readings.
The readings and the questions.
I got down the wrong verse. When you said that Jesus was quoting the Great Commission, given to the blessing given to either Isaac or Jacob.
Yeah.
What was the verse you were referencing?
It's the third verse in the Great Commission. It's 28:20.
What I hope we're going to do. Barb has made up a schedule of the Wednesdays.
That's what I wrote down. You're saying Genesis 28:20.
No, Matthew 28:20 corresponds to Genesis 28:15.
Oh, 28. Oh, okay.
Doing two sessions on one day or two sessions in one day.
Oh,
okay.
In both cases, it's chapter 28.
Right.
There's 15. But this does not, it does not compare. You have to compare the Greek Old Testament with the Greek New Testament.
In the Hebrew Old Testament?
Yeah.
No, not the Hebrew.
You just can't do it. We may be going until May.
The Hebrew came 1,000 years later. Mm-hmm. So they only had to work with the Greek Old Testament. Jesus was reading from the Greek Old Testament.
All he was doing was reading.